Imagine being told you had stage 4 cancer and had 12 weeks to live. That is what happened to my guest today on Radio Gorgeous. With determination and sheer doggedness, she took on her own healthcare into her own hands and tried everything, and I mean everything that was going. And that was 19 years ago. She's a trained physiotherapist, she's an entrepreneur, a sailor, a mother, a wife, and now she actively campaigns to help other patients with their care and research with off-med drugs and diet. We're talking about her story and book today, How to Starve Cancer Without Starving Yourself. She is Jane McClelland. I hope I've got it right.
You have.
Okay, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. So tell us about the fateful day when you're told you only had 12 weeks to live.
Yeah, it was that wasn't the first terminal diagnosis that I had. In 1999, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cervical cancer. This was after I'd been initially diagnosed in 94.
So this was same cervical cancer.
Same cancer. Mm-hmm. And that does have an average survival of about 3 months at stage 4, and you're certainly not expected to live beyond a year. And in fact, my sister's a medical doctor, and I didn't know, but she'd gone around the entire family just bracing everyone and said, look, she's not going to survive, brace yourself for this, she'll probably not even see the end of the year. I didn't know any of that, that she was saying that, and the doctors weren't saying that to me, but I'd looked up the statistics, I'd seen the average survival time, and we'd sort of tiptoed around the actual diagnosis and what it actually meant, and I knew full well what it meant. I was a trained physiotherapist, and I'd worked in the NHS for many years, and I kind of knew that doctors fudge things a little bit to sort of break you into bad news gently. They don't necessarily, some doctors go straight for it and say, you have got X number of weeks, months to live, and other people just give you pieces of paper with things to try and look up, and they're a bit cryptic and you have to try and work these things out, or you know, there are various
and percentages
ways.
Quite often, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they love
the
percentages.
Oh, they do. Oh my
it's
god,
so muddling.
Stats, yeah, stats exactly. Are their thing, you know. Yeah, they yeah. Love stats, and yeah. they thrive off stats. Mm. Stats is their big MO, their modus. So they're very orientated around the whole statistics and sort of, you know, and then they decide which chemo on statistics, they decide all these other treatments on statistics. But of course, when you're a cancer patient, you aren't a statistic. You are that statistic of one, because what you do can influence everything else. That the other treatments will have, you know, what bearing those treatments will have on you. So depending on whether you actually change your diet or add supplements or exercise or all these other, or you know, lifestyle changes that you can make can have a huge impact on your survival statistics. So I never saw that. It was depressing. Every time I looked at the figures, it would just kick me in the guts, you know, but I tried to ignore those stats as much as I possibly could, because otherwise it would have completely paralyzed me.
Devastated
with fear.
You.
Yeah, yeah. I was fearful anyway, but you know, it would have just so you just try and sort of park that if you possibly can, you know, pay attention to that and realize the magnitude of where you are, and then try and do whatever is necessary equivalent to that magnitude that's required. And my god, I did a lot, you know. So
should see the size of the book.
Yeah, well, it goes through an awful lot. There's a huge amount of information in there, all of it incredibly useful about the lifestyle changes you can make. You know, again, it has to be a personalized thing to who you are, to your metabolism, to the type of cancer that you have, to your actual lifestyle to start with, to the infections that you may have had in the past. There are a whole host of things.
The stage you are in your life,
yes,
even.
Exactly. Yeah. And even sort of, you know, you have things called your genetic SNPs will actually make up sort of how you react to some drugs better than others and supplements better than others. There is a whole host of stuff that is actually not taken into account by the oncology profession. This is where we're failing enormously, is we're not seeing the person as a whole. We're only seeing them as a, you know, the oncologist will see it as a lump that needs to be cut out or, you know, it's just very, they don't actually view the whole person.
So they're not holistic, basically.
They're not holistic, no. And this is, you know, the medical profession will not survive in its current format, because people are waking up to the fact that this is, we really are making a pretty shoddy attempt at trying to cure cancer.
Is it because we're still using, I mean, someone told me it was 1950s methods.
Yeah, that it has progressed very, very little. There are a few cancers that have really made progress, things like childhood leukemia. And
well, that's wonderful.
It is wonderful. And they've increased the survival stats up to about 90% now.
Brilliant.
Which is terrific. And the reason for that is that they use something called asparaginase.
Sounds like asparagus.
Precisely. Actually, asparagine is the... it's actually an amino acid, so that's a kind of a protein thingy. So it's a it's a little chunk of protein that the cancer will use. Cancer will use asparagine, okay? And asparagine is found in asparagus. And asparagus, actually, people don't realise, is something to avoid in many cancers, because this particular amino acid is actually really quite dangerous. And particularly for things like leukemia, you shouldn't have it. You should not be having asparagus. You should not be having asparaginine foods. And these are that you can look them up, and you can actually look up the fact that it's associated with increased progression with breast cancer and quite a few other cancers. And people focus a lot on glucose.
So why is this good for... I thought this was for childhood leukemia. It is good, but you said don't take it.
No. Okay, asparaginase is the enzyme that breaks it down, okay? And that actually stops it being used by the cancer. So it's blocking the ability of the cancer to use that to feed itself. It's all about starving the cancer.
Because that's the name of your book. Starving cancer. So we've got to think of cancer as a thing. Well, it does grow.
It grows.
So you've got to not feed it, really.
That is precisely...
Simple, it really.
Is, yeah, mm. The really mm. simple way to think about your cancer is that it is a parasite, okay? Mm. It is not you. Mm. It is a... Well, it kind of takes you on. It takes over your cells. It takes over your immunity, your blood supply, and it feeds off the nutrients that you supply it with. So the point is that, and it's got a very voracious appetite. It's really hungry. Okay, so it's hungry for fat, glucose, and some of these proteins that, you know, like the asparaginine, and also glutamine, sometimes arginine, but actually that's affected by this asparaginine amino acid. So this is where you've got to actually just understand what's driving your cancer to personalize your approach. This is something that I didn't work out entirely at the time, but I had this concept in my head back in, well, not in 99. Well, in 99, I knew I had to starve it, but it sort of progressed from there until 2003, when I then had leukemia developing as a result. Yeah, no, because I'd had the chemo and the radiotherapy, a massive, massive dose of that for my first cancer, I then ended up with this further problem developing.
That was when you were having a really good time as well. You started going to champagne bars and sailing again.
Yeah, you read that bit. Okay. All right. Well, I was, you know, I had slackened off a little.
Don't blame you. No, it's called living.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. So, and you know, keeping up with the diet for a long term.
Any diet that's very hard to do, which yours is, probably going out to restaurants was difficult.
Yes.
That's just such a pressure on you. Yeah. You know, I mean, even tomorrow night, I'm going out for dinner. We're trying to eat sort of, you know, no white sugar, no white carbs, all that sort of thing. But I'm just saying to my husband, I said, look, when we go out, we just can't do it. No. Let's just not do it and then just do it in the home. And it's so much, you know, but you had to do it because you were really doing it for your health.
Yes. And back then it was really difficult because, you know, these people didn't understand.
The word vegan hadn't even
it was very hard because asking for green tea in a restaurant was kind of, they would just offer me peppermint or they'd offer me something. You know, it was really hard to get them to understand what I wanted. But you got used to being a pest and a complete nuisance in the restaurant. And I always, in fact, actually, sometimes I still do, I take a little bottle of my own extra virgin olive oil to pour on stuff when
Your
I go out.
Antioxidants, yeah.
Well, it also blocks the uptake of bad fats. And fat is kind of neglected by a lot of people with cancer because they're so focused on glucose as being the big thing.
Everyone says sugar.
Yeah, but it isn't. You've got three macros in your diet. Mm. You've got carbs, fat, and protein. And if you block one, and this is what I describe in my book, it's sort of like Piccadilly Circus analogy. I describe it as you block one route, it will just reroute and come back in another one.
So it comes in as fat then?
Well, it can use fat. It can also, it can even use ketones. And ketones are a kind of fat, but people are
Ketones, aren't they found in meat and things?
Well, ketones, they're produced as a result of cutting right down on glucose, okay? Mm. So,
I know. They're the ones that when you go on that all meat diet and everyone gets bad breath.
The Atkins. It used to be the Atkins diet, but people, it's kind of morphed.
Dukan diet, all those ones.
Yeah, it's morphed into sort of the ketogenic diet. Now, there are various different ways to do the ketogenic diet, and some of them may be better than others for different cancers. But essentially, there are these. A lot of people do well initially on the ketogenic diet because it's cutting right down on that sugar.
Yes.
But then, of course, it can rewire itself or reroute itself and come back in through a different route and use glutamine. We talked about at the start about asparaginine. Well, that is an amino acid that cancer will use. So it will actually go back in through the asparaginine route. Glutamine is part. It's very close to glutamine. Glutamine is kind of like the most.
I've heard of glutamine. Is it the sort of thing that's in sort of sports drinks?
Correct. It's actually the most abundant amino acid in our body, and actually, cutting down on that will. It's very hard.
It nearly kills you, sort of.
Well, if you cut down on that, you will actually affect your gut, you'll affect your brain. So it's actually quite dangerous to block it completely to those areas. But what you want to do is block it getting to the cancer. And cancer uses specific enzymes, it uses specific transport mechanisms, and you can block it in an indirect way without having to block it directly. So you're not.
Can you give me an example? I'm really intrigued.
Okay, green tea.
Yeah.
It helps to block glutamine transport. And this is why it's so good for cancer. And in fact, I have been drinking green tea pretty much ever since I was, I discovered it back in the mid 90s.
And how many cups do you have a day? I'm intrigued.
Oh, a lot. And when I was
10?
I'd keep a big pot sort of on my... I've got an Aga. And we used to sort of... I used to make up a big pot with some other lovely concoctions as well. I sort of mix it in with other things because I actually hate it. I'm still not keen on it, but I drink it because I know how good it is. And it really is... One of the things that is sort of like my top things that you should do when you've got cancer is
so
take...
even without cancer, we should be drinking green tea every day.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's great for. Yeah. It may have some effects if you're pregnant, which won't be necessarily good for you.
Okay, so did you hear that? Don't have it when you're pregnant.
Yeah, well, only because it's sort of blocking this growth.
Growth is what you're trying to do.
Exactly.
Grow something.
Exactly. Yeah. So, all of these things should probably not be taken if you're pregnant. But this is very hard if you because actually a fetus is almost like a parasite inside you. And it's a sort of the same kind of thing. So, so you can't. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Weird. But anyway, that's the way to view it, is that you're trying to block the growth by starving it, okay? And
you Jane, don't want to how did do you find all this out? Because it's incredibly detailed information, which is not available anywhere.
No, it isn't. And this is the thing, it's not. And honestly, if you saw my library at home of cancer books, it is vast. I mean vast. And that's not just books. I've got huge amounts of journals and things as well. And massive amounts of printouts that I've done from various things and I've put into files, yes. So it's, and my spare room was just rammed. So, I mean, really, it was an enormous quantity of research that I did because there was, and I've now, I mean, I parked it for a while because obviously I had, we'll get to, I mean, you probably want to discuss the story, but I mean, I ended up having a surrogate because I couldn't carry my own children. I ended up having children. So when I had children, I had to sort of, I parked the whole, I was able to just say, right, that is part of my life that's gone. So I didn't do any research. I kind of, I kept a little bit going with people, because you can't, because people come to you and they say, you survived.
Yeah.
How did you do it?
Yeah, and you just can't stop being, this is your role now in life.
I kind of feel it is. Yeah. I've not really chosen this, but.
Yeah, it's chosen you.
It has. But that even when, you know, when I, so when I was having children, I kind of was able to park an awful lot of that research.
And how do you need a spare room, darling?
Yeah, I know. But having had that break, it gave me that.
Yes, I know about having breaks. That but
it,
also.
Yeah, yeah, it gave me that ability to sit back and think, you know what, let's look at the big picture here, because you can get so bogged down with the nitty gritty.
Yes.
And this is, again, where we have failed with cancers. We head down these tiny little research avenues and we say, right, we're going to look at that tiny little bit of that genetic problem. We're going to have a tiny look at this little genetic. And these research grants are given to a lot of universities based on tiny, small, and they get more and more reductionist because they have to find something to do to get these financial awards granted for these universities. But they're all looking at smaller and smaller things, and they're not really getting a big picture of the whole, what's, you know, the whole parasitic element of what the cancer's doing. And it just screamed out to me. And even back, you know, in 2003, 2004, again, when I had another little hiccup, that this was clearly the way forward was to starve it. And the things that I had chosen during that, you know, it was more and more obvious to me as I kept looking at research and thinking, you know what, starving cancer is actually the key. It's the key to getting the stem cell. It's the key to getting rid of that, because the stem cell is the little blip that, you know, actually starts. It's the initiator of
Isn't
the cancer.
Isn't it like it divides or something?
It's a slower dividing cell. Mm. So it's much slower cycling. So it feeds, but it's actually much more wily. And it can do this mutation, and it can change the way it feeds depending on the environment. It's very sneaky.
I don't get how you said you can kind of literally localize where you know the root. In other words, you can sort of find the cancer in the body, and but you can take other things. How can you do that?
Well, this is where, you know, the diet will help to a certain point, but you can't actually starve the cancer without, I don't think, the use of supplements and these off-label drugs. There are some very good alternative supplements to some of the drugs, but, you know, the drugs are actually very focused and targeted at getting some of these things. And the drugs that I took, just to run through what they were, so I took metformin later on. This was, I'd started off by taking a supplement called berberine, which is kind of a natural equivalent to metformin. It has very strong glucose-reducing properties, and it makes insulin much more sensitive, so you don't have this huge spike of insulin. And insulin will push nutrients into your cancer cell, so you want to keep that down. So the berberine I took in 99. I discovered that in 99. I actually then discovered metformin as being the drug in 2007, very similar, but in fact they have slightly different effects on different pathways. So they're actually, I actually alternate between the two now. I still take them.
Wow.
Still take them. So that's kind of like my big two. But lovastatin I knew was really good for my particular cancer, but it turns out that statins, if you get the right type of statin, are actually very good for every cancer. These block some the cholesterol pathway called the mevalonate pathway, and this is really fired up in cancer, so it overworks and it sort of builds because it's wanting to make new cholesterol blobs for its daughter cells. So if you imagine, so cancer in effect is a sort of a constant replication of itself. It's sort of dividing and producing two daughters. So in order to do that, it has to double in size. And in order to double in size, it needs the protein and the fat to do that. That's essentially what cells are. They are a fatty membrane with protein inside. That's a very basic example of what the cells are. So to make the fatty membranes, it needs cholesterol. So if you block the cholesterol, it can't make those fatty membranes. So that's kind of very key to sort of starving it.
And were these drugs, are these drugs from a doctor or are these drugs from, I don't get
one. Well, I got all of them from doctors, but not just one.
Okay.
I was scared of getting them all from, I thought I probably wouldn't achieve that, getting them all from the same doctor. So I had, in fact, actually at one stage I had three complementary doctors and my oncologist. So, and I was sort of gleaning information, because of course this was the days before there was too much information on the internet.
So it was
So I was just getting information from everywhere that I possibly could. Mm. So I had these three complementary doctors. I had my oncologist, and she was back then. Mm. She was actually very, and I chose her because she was, you know, quite receptive to what I was doing.
She's a woman as well.
She's a woman, great. And she respected what I was doing. Mm. She didn't think I was completely.
Didn't think you're nuts.
No. Well. Mm. A lot of people did, of but, you know.
Because you were so proactive, and that's so unusual.
And people were saying, oh, well, you know, you waste your time, diets won't work, you're just mad.
Especially then, God.
Yeah, so but I ignored it. And I thought, you know what, I've done my own research. I know, you know, that glucose fires it up. Otto Warburg, who's this German scientist, had discovered that the whole metabolism of cancer, the way it feeds itself, was different. He discovered that back in the, in fact, actually the 1920s, I think he started his research, but actually the 1950s, it really came to the fore. But then it was kind of ignored because everybody focused then on the genetics. And the genetics is actually down the line from the metabolism. So
it makes sense because your metabolism is number one, isn't it? It's the first thing. The metabolism is you. It makes everything move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I describe, because people are very confused about what triggers cancer, you know, is it infectious, is it toxins, is it...
Hereditary.
There is a whole host of these things.
Hormonal.
Well, all these factors will actually play a part, but the big, big driving force behind any cancer, all of these things will cause inflammation.
Or depression or anxiety or illness or...
Yeah. Well, all of these affect either inflammation or the metabolism, in fact. So, you know, depression will depress various things in your metabolism and lower your white cell. You know, you actually lower your immunity, your ability to fight off these diseases. So it's a combination of very many factors. So to say, you know, so I've kind of given an overview as to sort of how it starts. But then once it starts, the actual progression of cancer is actually common to every single cancer in the way that the metabolism changes, but certain pathways are more fired up in some cancers than others. So
how have you found out that?
From research. And I'm kind of on the cutting edge of this because nobody's really cottoned on to the fact that different cancers are actually very hungry for certain cancer. You know, like the leukemia is very hungry for this asparaginine. Some cancers like endometrial are very driven by glucose, you know, whereas the leukemias are very driven by all these protein amino acids.
What about breast cancer? Because that's the most common.
Yeah, fat and glucose for very many. You know, the worst one is triple negative breast cancer, which kind of wants everything. So that's why it's so aggressive and makes it quite tricky to treat, because it wants both, you know, all three. So it wants fat, glucose, and it fires off the glutamine. And actually when it starts, and this is how most cancers start, actually, they start with glucose and a bit of fat, and then very often they then develop to then getting more aggressive by using the amino acids, this glutamine, later on. But there's always an element of that anyway, but it just becomes hungrier and able to utilize everything better. It gets more specialized.
I mean, am I being silly to think, well, if I give up fats and I give up sugar, I mean, if I have cancer, I'll be okay? Is it that simple?
No. nothing is simple. That's why it's so hard to cure. If cancer was a very simple concept, then it would be, you know, it would
solved.
Be cured by now.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
we are still stuck in this situation where we are doing one treatment at a time.
Okay, now I just want to say you did have chemotherapy, didn't you? And radiation.
I did.
So you didn't negate, I mean, I've interviewed some people and they didn't have anything, you know. Whereas you decided to bring it on, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I can see the value of radiotherapy and I can see the value of chemotherapy. What I can't see the value of is giving huge doses when you are supplying the body with other targets to treat at the same time.
Yes, especially because it kills the immune system and that's what you need to fight.
Well, exactly. So my whole ethos is to try and increase the number of pathways that we're attacking on, because if you do that, then you don't need the same quantity of chemo or radiotherapy.
And chemo makes and, you and then, shit. Anyway.
Exactly. So what you're trying to do is really knock down all of those terrible immune depleting and frankly, you feel like, you know, so I mean, the, all
swear
of those,
on radio
hurrah, thank God for that. Okay, so and I did. I felt absolutely awful. Not, you know, Radio Gorgeous. I'm looking okay today.
You're beautiful,
but I tell
by
you
the
what,
way. You should see her. She's absolutely gorgeous.
Well, thank you. But I tell you what, there have been times in my life where I have been far from gorgeous. And I put on weight and I just felt terrible. You know, these treatments are just awful. And they actually, you know, I've got lymphedema in my right leg. It's not so bad now, but it did swell up. It was about a third bigger the size of it. And this is all because of not just the surgery, but radiotherapy as well. And this is what caused the leukemia later on. You know, I was developing this therapy-related leukemia, which is pretty impossible to cure.
I just want to say something, because I think one of the big things in the book that I picked up was your mother died of cancer.
Yes.
And that made you more motivated. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was pretty shocking, because I think actually, in some ways, me getting cancer after she got cancer was very devastating. And I think a lot of grief gets internalized and comes out. Sometimes it really, I think it is linked to cancer in a lot of ways.
Grief.
Yes. And I think, you know, you withhold all these emotions. And she wasn't very good at expressing her feelings, to be honest. But I was absolutely devastated that she got cancer. And I felt a little bit guilty, to be honest, because my cancer had probably stimulated her secondary. She got cancer first. Then I got cancer, then she got the secondary, then I got the secondary. But, of course, she died in 96 and I got my secondary in 99. But, you know, it was a massive, massive wake-up call for me to watch her die.
How old was she and what was it?
She was 60. She had breast cancer.
60?
Yeah. So she...
Really young.
Yeah. And I just searched everywhere. And this is what made me wake up to the whole idea that we were missing this huge swathe of potential treatments. I didn't know much about the off-label drugs at that point, but I knew that there were supplements. I knew there were things that were really important, like the green tea, like the, you know, all these things. And this is when I started, you know, well, I got my name Maracas, because I started building up this enormous quantity of supplements that I was taking. And I was taking them every mealtime. So I would have these bags, these Ziploc packs of you know, probably about 20 supplements per meal that I was taking. And even between meals, I'd have little sachets of enzymes
and things. Yeah.
I was looking at this is, you know, how serious it got. And I'm not organized. I can tell you I'm seriously disorganized. But I knew that I could only survive if I got myself very focused, very organized. I would spend an hour or so on a Friday afternoon setting myself up for the weekend, so I was already prepared. I could go out, I could spend the weekend, go sailing if I fell up to it, you know, and then and live my life the way I wanted to live it, because otherwise it would have been hell. Because you are, as a cancer patient, you feel like you've got to be doing all this juicing, you feel like you've got to be doing rebounding, which is bouncing up and down on a trampoline or something, you know. But I don't think actually there are certain things which I have come to the conclusion you can moderate or you can adjust to fit into your lifestyle a little bit better.
Good.
And I kind of try and steer people to sort of making life just that little bit more manageable. And the point is that, yeah, there are a lot of supplements, there are a lot of drugs, but this is the point, is that we got to this point where patients were driving the whole momentum of curing or at least controlling HIV, mm-hmm. and this is what I'm trying to achieve with cancer,
mm-hmm.
is driving this patient revolution, saying, right, we don't have a cure because of the way that we're set up. Pharmaceutical industry only tests one drug at a time.
Only a drug that can make money for them.
Yeah. These are, I mean, hugely expensive immunotherapy drugs. Immunotherapy is the kind of the key thing at the moment. Everybody's, you know, jumping up and down about immunotherapies. But actually, when you look at the stats, you only get about 8 to 10% improvement. And in fact,
nothing.
Which, some of these people do very well, and you've got to work out why. And most of them that do well are actually improving their gut and starving the cancer as well. But the other reason, the other thing that is not revealed and is not fully recognized yet, is that you get a 16 to 18% of hyperprogression. So these cancer patients actually go into hyperdrive with their cancer and they die much, much quicker. And it's patients aren't told that because oncologists are so delighted that they get anybody with a stage four having any kind of result, that they will grasp onto that and just completely ignore the fact that there are these other patients who are doing particularly badly.
This
and they
is
kind
terrifying.
Of blanket.
This is
but I know, and they don't recognise it, and they don't. This is obviously not explained to patients because the oncologists don't even recognise it themselves.
Also, the oncologists, as you say, they're just seeing the biggest picture, they're just seeing the stats, they're seeing the bigger picture in the way that, like, oh, that works if we look at the list. You know, they're not saying, you, what are you? You know, let's look at you.
Yeah.
So, Jane, I really actually, I want to ask at the end how you do help people personally. But let's go back to your story about your life. You were brought up in Guernsey?
Guernsey, yeah. Yeah.
So I'll just tell people, it's a tiny island. There's Alderney, Guernsey and Jersey, aren't there?
Yeah, Sark.
And Sark and Herne. And they're lovely little islands.
My favourite places.
Just off sort of Cherbourg, really. They should belong to France, but they belong to England.
Yeah.
And it's very yachty, isn't it?
It is.
So you were brought up in this wonderful yachty household.
Yeah, it was fantastic. My dad always sailed and I was brought up sailing and it was fantastic. Guernsey's a very safe place. They've just released, recently last year, they had the Guernsey Literary Potato Peel Pie Society, so, which wasn't filmed in Guernsey,
where was it filmed?
It was filmed down in Devon. Anyway, I still haven't seen it actually.
It's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I've read the book.
The book was great, wasn't it?
So I will see that, but I will get annoyed, I think.
Yeah, you will. It'll wind you up.
It will. But anyway, so I was brought up there, and then I trained as a physio. And
yeah, why was you interested in physiotherapy?
I've always been interested in health, and my mother kind of instilled that in me.
Oh.
When I was at boarding school.
It's always an inspiration.
At boarding school, and she'd send me these health. Every week there'd be these cutouts from newspaper and she'd clip out these sort of little, read this. And so she was constantly, pushing health in.
Was she healthy?
She did dancing and almost until, up until she was very, very ill.
And what about her diet?
It was quite rich and she was sold the whole flora is great and the whole
of course.
Margarine
Everybody
thing
was in the 80s
and
70s.
So she
what
switched.
We were told though we
exactly.
were told low fat
so she was I think back to my cupboard and the fridge and what we had in there and it was all the wrong fats, it was all the wrong, we had Guernsey butter, which is terribly, it's very rich and
actually good for you.
Well, Guernsey butter is and Guernsey milk is actually some of the best in the world because it's very high in beta-carotene. It's actually an A2 milk, which is an ancient herb, which means you digest it better. And actually, on Saturdays, I get a delivery from a Guernsey herd in Herefordshire.
Lovely.
And it's delivered directly to my home because it's raw. Okay, so I've gone back to having a bit of raw milk. I don't suggest that people, if they're pregnant, if they got young kids, to do it. But when kids get to a certain age, it's probably okay, as long as their immune systems are fine. And best to check with a doctor first. And you need to make sure of the source of the milk is reputable as well. But raw milk has got huge benefits over pasteurized, and it's
natural.
It's got all the right. We with the pasteurisation process, we are
boiling.
Killing...
Well, if you boil anything, it's going to kill it.
Yeah. So anyway, so Guernsey milk should be the best in the world, but of course we're, you know, and they don't understand this. I'm going over. I've got I'm hopefully talking at the Guernsey Literary Festival this year.
Fabulous.
So I'll actually make a point of making sure they're all fully aware that Guernsey milk is the best in the world because it's got so many beneficial nutrients in there that are particularly good, and they should be making more of it, and they should be. Maybe, you know, marketing it a lot more than they are. Anyway, so they're
missing a trick. So you're brought up there, your mum was health, you decided to become a physiotherapist. Where did you train?
Trained in the Midlands. Didn't really like it there.
Uni?
Yeah.
Then what, Loughborough or something?
No, I was. I ended up in Wolverhampton.
Oh, poor you. Sorry to anyone that's...
No, I didn't enjoy it.
No, after you'd been on that idyllic island.
It was awful. I hated it, actually. Mm. But I enjoyed the course.
Yeah.
And as soon as I had finished, I was out of there, you know.
And you ran away where? To London?
I went down to... I went back to Guernsey initially.
Mm.
And then I worked on the south coast...
so you could easily get back to Guernsey.
Yes, various coastal towns. Ended up in Cornwall for a couple of years as well, which I loved. And then I sort of headed back towards Surrey area and then London. Kind of been in London for far too long now. But I've worked in many hospitals, and it's been quite a varied career with some of my physio. But I specialised in... I was very into the neurology side of things. So I worked a lot with stroke patients, head injuries, MS, that kind of thing. Those were, I enjoyed that. I found it very rewarding.
Yeah.
And then orthopedics was kind of, and I did a lot with sort of sports and things. I had quite a few top sports people come to me and stuff. So that was all quite...
And what about your personal life?
Personal life.
You're married?
Yes. Been engaged a few times.
Good on you.
So,
what fun.
No, sort of running away from them. And then I ended up with Andrew. Ended up, that sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
No.
Does he have any links to Guernsey or sailing?
He sailed, when he was younger, he sailed around Guernsey and Herm and Sark. So we may have bumped into each other in a former life.
But that means you understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. And he has this deep affinity for the Channel Islands as well, which really helps.
Yeah,
so
really
he
helps.
Has absolutely no qualms about going to Guernsey during the summer. We've actually now got a motorboat rather than a sailing boat.
Yeah, well, you can go places.
Yeah, exactly. And we have a little sailing dinghy, which we stick on the davits at the back. But we go over to Guernsey and then just we're able to go to Herm, which the kids love. You know, it's just idyllic. I shouldn't be telling anyone because, you know, there'll be too many people. Exactly. And the fact is...
It's your beach.
Yes. Yeah. So,
I feel like about that beach is in Dorset. What are they doing on here?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's absolutely heaven for them.
Oh, brilliant. So what stage in your life were you at when the cancer appeared?
I was 30.
Mm.
And I just started going out with Andrew, actually. And I had been investigated for cervical changes at a hospital in South London.
For what reason?
Because I'd
blood
had,
or
yeah, I'd had dysplasia. Now I'd gone
What's
to this
dysplasia.
It's sort of abnormal cells, and
how had they found that?
Smears, you know.
Okay.
So I'd been referred to.
That's good.
Yeah,
you went for your smears.
All that. Yeah. I was doing that religiously, you know, and I went to see this guy at this South London hospital, and I went through a whole court case. Well, we didn't actually go. We settled out of court.
Yeah.
But I went through the whole suing him because it was just shocking. There was a national recall of all his patients. It was so awful. Oh. And when you look back at what he was doing, the work that he was doing was just so shoddy. He really wasn't following up people enough. Yeah. He was not doing the biopsies properly. Oh. They were in the wrong place. There were, you know, not enough of them. He was only doing 64% or something rather than over 90% because
has he been struck off now?
Well, because I settled out of court and every other woman probably died, so they didn't. I was the only one kind of left to take any action. And because we settled out of court, it never went in front of the GMC.
Wow.
So
he's still out there.
He's still out there. He's not allowed to work for the NHS. Mm. They struck him off their list. Wow. So he's never worked for the NHS. Yeah, but
private's even more frightening. You think you're paying
exactly,
for the best.
Exactly. Yeah. And I hope, and all of this checking up on your colleagues has come in since.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's been a whole... Because one of the other things that was highly suspicious was that he... I've never mentioned this before. Mm. But he came out and made me another appointment. And the clerk said, well, you haven't got a surgery that day. A clinic that day. And he went, oh, no, I've made a special one. Now, I turned up on that clinic day, nobody around at all. And I wonder whether he'd actually done this to other patients to say, oh, well, she's progressed because she didn't turn up to her appointment, because he'd given me the wrong day.
God.
You know, or God. Done something where, and God. This is,
so he
this
really
is all,
was dodgy.
I wonder whether there wasn't an element of Harold Shipman about him.
God.
You know, I have my deep suspicions, but that's why I haven't actually mentioned his name in the book, because, you know, if you start throwing those kind of accusations around. Yeah. But honestly, it was so, when I think back to the way he treated me, the what he was doing and what he's done to other women and the kind of excuses he made, I really am very doubtful.
Well, just to let you know, listeners, that not most people are good.
Yes, and the checks are in place now. Yeah. Nothing, you know, all of these things are followed up with, that you can't, nothing's
written anymore.
Also because
of a computer, because of Google and stuff.
Yes,
you
exactly.
You can look people up.
Yes.
You can, there's no hiding anymore.
No, you know, it's far more open and you can't get away with the kind of things that were done in the past.
Yeah, good. Well, it was like finding the Ripper, you know what I mean? Just, it was all different bits of paper, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's a filing system
that
went wrong.
But that was, that was...
But now everything's digital, so... So you got some strange cells.
Yeah. I went to the specialist at this hospital, you know, he was meant to be, and it turned out he actually wasn't even a consultant. He claimed to be a consultant and he wasn't.
Wow.
He was calling himself a mister.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he'd been elevated to this status because nobody else had filled the job, but he wasn't actually, you know.
He was a fantasist.
Totally.
Anyway, so
let's
carry
move on from
carry
there,
on.
Because I shall get cross.
Exactly. We don't want that.
No, I've managed to park that. But, you know, what worries me is he's still out there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we get past that. Where are we? So what?
You've been to South London, you found the cells.
Yes, and then it just happened.
Is cancer in your family? Is cancer in your family?
No. Well,
I mean, your mum died of it.
My mum died of it, and my grandparents on my father's side died of it. But you know what? This whole genetic thing is far less than we you know, breast cancer is only 5% genetic. And it's mostly...
So these people that have both their breasts off, it's a bit dramatic, is it?
Well, it is a bit dramatic when you realise that actually you can influence, with your lifestyle, you can influence whether it triggers these changes or not. The BRCA1 and the BRCA2... are influenced. You can switch these genes on or switch them off.
Wow.
Now the BRCA1, they're actually tumor suppressors, so you want to keep them going. But actually suppressing them is, you know, so it's sort of like, anyway, what you need to know is that you can adjust the way these things are switched on and switched off.
Mm-hmm.
And that even if you have BRCA1, BRCA2, doesn't mean that you are going to necessarily be a victim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a lot you can do, and Angelina Jolie is kind of set a precedent, which I think is a bad one. I guess she did what she thought
dramatic
was best.
Surgery.
Yeah, she did what she thought was best at the time, but her breast surgeon has now come out to say, you know what, I was wrong. There's an awful lot. She's brought out a book as well, saying, oh, diet. Oh, I didn't realise. Oh, it could do so much. And, you know, I just think, idiot. Anyway, but they haven't. They've been going down their own path. Doctors, bless them, are very busy people, and they do their best.
And also, they're doctors. They're working in this medical world.
Yeah, and
you know, they're not holistic nutritionists. They're not naturopaths. No. They're not. You know, but that's what they've got to become. Sorry, doctors, you've got to wise up.
Totally, and I have some good friends who are doctors, and you know they. hate me for
the
saying
ones you
this,
like.
But, yes, but they, you know, even so, I just want to shake them sometimes and just say, "Wake up!"
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But
you so know. You had the cells, and you were 30. Oh no, the cancer came at 30.
Yes.
So your poor husband has
and this
been
was
through
3 months,
all of it.
Totally, you know, and we were it was devastating for us as a couple. For me to have that right on at the beginning of the it really changed the whole dynamics of the relationship between us, really, because, you know, I'd wanted children and
did you have a total hysterectomy?
Massive it's called a Wertheim's hysterectomy, where they take
and
out
how old were you?
Lymph nodes. So I was 30. So it was pretty devastating.
Massive.
I was hugely depressed for years after this. It really had a massive effect on
my... Well, also it means that you're, you know, you've gone into menopause and, you know, really young.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, but again, there probably wasn't much out there to help you on, you know, the emotions, the feelings.
No, it was just...
And also being a woman, you know, you've lost your womanhood.
Yes.
And did that mean then, at that stage, that you thought you're never going to have children?
Oh, totally. I kind of looked at surrogacy and thought, you know what, that is something that at least if I haven't got a womb, and there was a brief window between having the surgery, so taking my womb out and before I had the chemo and the radiotherapy, where I knew my ovaries were still functioning, but the surgeon, bless him, had moved my ovaries to a point where he said, well, I'll just pin them back out of the radiotherapy field, and I'd asked him to try and save my ovaries and to, because I knew this work on, it was very new at the time, but actually just saving chunks of ovary, freezing it and then being able to stimulate them later to produce eggs was something that was being developed up in, it was a Professor Gosden in Liverpool was doing this work, and I'd spoken to Professor Gosden and I'd tried to get him on, but you know, I was trying to do everything just to rescue my my ability to keep my fertility. But anyway, so I was desperate for this to happen. Of course, you know, he didn't really pay attention to that, didn't
he? He was concentrating on other things.
Yeah, I just thought, oh, this, you know.
So you lost everything, but you still got married though?
Still got married. Took him a while to get around to that, but yes. Didn't desert me. We had our ups and downs as, you know, it was... fairly hard. It put an awful lot of pressure on the relationship. Just having that sort of hanging over your head doesn't help.
Did you feel like you had to be the carer?
You know what? I was pretty self-sufficient.
Well, I can tell you are.
I don't.
That's one characteristic of
what
you've got.
Yeah, I don't like to make people feel like I'm a drag on them financially. I have to admit, I was a bit of a burden. But you know, in terms of actually.
Emotional.
Well, I kept my emotion. I was pretty depressed, but I tried to keep those feelings away from other people. So I'd be crying on my own, and I'd be, you know, I'd try and put on that, you know, that mask. But it
very
was
British.
Very British, stiff upper lip, darling. So yes, I was doing all of that, and I think it was, you know, burying an awful lot.
Okay, so you went through, we're going to talk about the diet right at the end to keep people listening so they can know. But tell me about the step of deciding to have children. So you'd had the cancer, you got through so many traumas, your mum had died, everything. You'd gone through just terrible, terrible time. What gave you the idea of having a child? You'd heard about surrogacy, but how did you go about it?
There was an agency that I'd heard of called COTS, which is Childlessness Overcome Through Surrogacy. And... it hadn't got very many members at the time.
What year is this?
Well, I started looking at it pretty early on because I needed to keep that sort of
hope.
Hope alive that something was possible. Yeah. We'd looked at adoption and I wasn't eligible because of my medical history. You have to be five years clear. So, but you know, I mean, once
don't
and then
them. Yeah, because you could be an orphan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, they say kids, if they're up for adoption, have already been through trauma. They've already had problems in their life.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be piling on more, and that's perfectly understandable. Yeah. So, it was hard, but you know.
So what did COTS do then?
They put you in touch. They go through a whole vetting process of they interview you. They interview surrogates. But in fact, back in those days, there were very few surrogates around and it was very unheard of still. And people viewed it as a bit bizarre and
okay,
weird.
I've got to go into medical now. So this, yeah. You're using her eggs and your husband's sperm, is that right?
Well, actually, it was far more complicated than that. Because I decided...
Knowing you, Jane, it was.
No, I know. So so I decided emotionally it would be easier for the surrogate if there was another egg donor. So, in fact, I had an egg donor to start with who was a good friend of mine.
Oh, wow.
And she was amazing. She did two cycles. She gave us 8 eggs the first time and 12 the second.
How good a friend is she?
Amazing. Amazing.
Is she your best friend?
We're still in touch, but yeah. she's miles away now. But anyway.
Wow. Has she had children herself?
Yes. But okay. she'd already had
okay,
kids.
Great. And that's, so, yeah, you know, again, she's come important. To terms of it. Yeah.
But she was very happy to be an egg donor for me.
Mm-hmm. What did you like that idea? The idea that it was like two different things inside her and she was just a carrier.
She was, exactly. So yeah. I just thought emotionally it'd just be easier for her. But we had to go through several surrogates to actually achieve. And in fact, all the egg donation never worked.
What?
So we went through all of that and it was a complete...
Fiasco.
Yeah, it was a huge waste of... You know,
time,
I just
money,
yeah, and
emotion.
I felt everybody involved. It was just lots of toing and froing, and just the doctor involved was just raking it in. And I have my suspicions about really
desperate
how
people.
Much effort they really put into doing these things properly.
Yeah,
you know, I think
they know they've got people that will pay anything.
Yeah, I'm deeply suspicious about whether they could actually get much better results than they do.
God, yeah, that's Hopefully another podcast.
That is, and yeah.
In the end, did you use a surrogate? With
yes,
her?
And it was what's known as straight surrogacy. So after all this fiasco, we were back at square one, and then I wrote to Cots again and said, "Look, we're going to have to look for a straight surrogate rather than a donor surrogate." And the lady said, "Fine, I think I've got just the person," and she was absolutely adorable. So as soon as I met Tabitha, it was like, she's the one. So she was my angel.
So is it a test tube baby? Is it?
No. The self-insemination.
Right.
But so...
Well, what do I do it with? Sorry, I love going to details.
Syringe.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you can do it with a syringe.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it's poor Andrew. Anyway, he was doing his business and then we'd pass this little pot of stuff. Anyway, don't need to know the full details, but
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. And then she just would leave her to lie down and do her business.
Okay.
And then, you know.
Put your legs up in the wall.
Exactly. And
did
leave
I really say that?
Yeah, well, yeah, well, wow. You know she'd do that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And it worked.
Not initially. It
still
took.
How many times?
Well, we actually had a few misses, you know. So we had miscarriage at 9 weeks, another one at 12 weeks. And then we had
this.
A triploidy, which is kind of a triplicate of a particular chromosome, which means that they don't survive. These babies don't survive. So we actually went through an abortion. And
oh,
that was.
This sounds.
I mean, it was
hell.
Yeah, no, it was. It was utter hell, and I just thought every time I thought, Tabitha, there's no way she'll go
but
back and
do
it again.
Did you ever think that like something was against you? Did you ever get paranoid?
No, just
think
look.
That...
My life has always been a battle, you know. So I seem to. Yeah, I just.
You trap them. Yeah.
Maybe I don't. I just.
Your soul. Your. Destiny.
Anyway, whatever. I just thought, let's keep plugging away. If she's happy to do it again.
And she was.
Well,
amazingly. God, no wonder you love her. Yeah.
So, yeah, she's brilliant. Mm. So she went ahead and did this one more time. And it was that sort of hurrah, you know, we finally got to. And I think maybe the other ones were girls because Andrew doesn't have girls in his family. There may be an issue with producing girls. Anyway, I don't know. We shouldn't. Mm. Mention that anyway, but
have you had how many? So you had a baby boy.
Had a baby boy, and then she had the surrogate had another baby herself, and then 3.5 years later, after my first son was born, we then had Sam. So so I've now got two boys.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Happy ending.
Oh God, what a yeah. But then you've got to become a mother, which
yes,
is another trauma.
It's another... Whole new can of worms. But yeah. So
yeah, you think it'll be the end, but it's just
no.
the beginning.
Oh my goodness. They've not
a worrying
been easy.
Rest of your life.
Yeah. No, children are easy. They are delightful. Yeah, yeah, they're very special.
Oh, they are. So, Do they know Beth Sarrogate?
Oh God, yes. They've known pretty much since they, you know. And in fact, Jamie, my 12-year-old, has just started to read the last week. He said, "Right, Mum, I'm reading your book." I said, no, wait till you're older. Yeah. And anyway, there's a whole load of stuff in there. I kind of wish he didn't read until he was a bit older. But anyway, he's come back to me and said, "Mum, it's made me closer to you. I can understand it now." And he's loving the book. So it's not like it's, you know, my book isn't just this heavy, it is actually quite readable. I think a lot of people get kind of put off because they think it's going to be all this technical info, but my part one, I've got two parts to it. Part one, which is 75% of the book, is really my story, and it just weaves the medical stuff in. I didn't want it to be too hard to digest. I wanted people to be able to read it as a story, and then, you know, I mean, it's quite, it actually, I feel a bit weird knowing that people know so much about me.
You have laid yourself on the line.
Completely bare.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's a situation I try and park, actually. I don't like to think about that too much.
No, I'm like that with podcasts when I've talked about orgasms and things. I think, oh, shit, who is going to hear this?
So, really weird. But anyway, but Jamie's just started to really read it.
Well, that's wonderful.
Fully understand. Sam, I think, probably less so. He lets life ride over him quite happily. But Jamie he's quite a sensitive child.
Number one, normally is.
He's very interested
and
in science.
Do they see Tabitha?
Yes, not very often, but yeah, yes, and we keep in touch. So
that's lovely. Yeah, that's so
and
nice.
They fully understand, you know.
And have you had any scares since you've had since they've been born?
Well, no, I'm constantly scaring myself.
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna say. Do you you kind of think, oh God,
once you've had such a terrible diagnosis, I can tell you that you never ever stop worrying that it's gonna come back and smite you. So, you know, you're constantly on the lookout. So every cough, every cold is another lung met, or, you know, or every headache is a brain met or something. So you are constantly
vigilant
in the background. But it's got easier.
Mm.
And people who are listening who may have stage four or something and battling through, and, you know, you can beat it. Stage four is not terminal. I don't see, you know, I will die, but, you know, not hopefully. It's taken a long time for this terminal cancer to kill me, and hopefully it'll take an awful lot longer yet. So
okay, great. Now let's get to the starving the cancer. What diet did you do then?
Okay, well, the number one thing is low glycemic, so that is cutting out high release sugar. So the white sugars and the flour is actually very bad. White rice, you need to get their whole, you know, baked potato, fries are terrible. There's a whole host of things that you need to cut out, and there are websites and things that will show you the glycemic index of foods.
What about fruit? Because I always worry about that, because people are now saying, oh God, stop eating fruit. And I really love things like, I've got some, you know, dates downstairs.
They're very sugary.
Are yummy, they bad?
And very yummy.
Yeah.
Well, they're less like, you know.
They're less bad.
As long as what you have to do is take an overall picture of the glycemic load. So it's not just glycemic index. It's sort of how you mix things together and the release of the foods. But also, this is where the supplements and these drugs that I used, and I'm not suggesting people should take drugs as a preventative. But, you know, when I had cancer, these were particularly good at actually helping just to reduce those nutrients
rushes.
It was the rush of the food going to the cancer, which is really hungry. And if it can't get it, it really gets.
So do you get more yearnings when you've got cancer for sweets?
Yeah, unfortunately, you can have quite a sort of, you know, you're. And if you've got bad gut bacteria, which are kind of linked to cancer anyway, I mean, almost virtually everybody. And I think a bad gut is probably the key to actually making sure that you prevent cancer.
So is that taking probiotics?
Probiotics, but it's not just saying, you've got to get the right mix of probiotics. Some probiotics are better than others.
If I go to my posh health food store in Chiswick and buy one that costs £25 and you have to keep in the fridge, would that probably be a good one?
Probably.
Yeah.
You need a sort of a quite a good range of mix, but you do need to make sure you're getting the bifidobacterium. And yes, there's a bifido, Brevet and Longum are particularly good, but mm-hmm. there are others that, you know, the Akkermensia and things like that, you can't get those, but actually metformin will help stimulate these. Metformin, which is this drug, this diabetic drug, will actually help improve the flora and fauna in your, it'll change the what's known as the bio, you know, the biosis, which is the sort of the mix of good and bad in the gut. So it will actually stop it becoming abnormal.
Okay, so just so we've only got about another 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so you low glycemic
yes,
diet.
Yes, that's number one. Yeah. That's number one. And fat is an interesting thing to look at, because obviously omega-3s are very good for you, and we don't get enough omega-3 in our diet.
Tell us
so
what
fish,
omega-3 is.
So these are the oils that you can find in fish and mackerel and
hemp.
Oily, yeah. Yes, mm. hemp. Oily fish predominantly are very good, but yes, there are flaxseed and things like that. But what you need to do is to make sure you get a much higher proportion of omega-3s, mm-hmm. because these will
so
actually...
go on a fish diet? Go on,
pescatarian says, yeah. is actually very, very beneficial for many cancers. Okay. Now, some cancers are so glutamine, which is this protein-driven, that you actually want to cut down even on...
Okay.
Fish, you know, yeah. and actually vegan for some cancers yeah. that are very aggressive yeah. may in fact be the way to go. And hopefully you won't have to do it forever. But, you know, this is a way of actually just getting on top of the cancer and actually just blocking the way it feeds. I can tell you right now that I'm not as good with my diet as I was, you yeah. know, back in 2000.
You become, you know, you're more relaxed because yeah. life's going yeah. well.
Yes. Yeah. Now, yeah. fingers crossed, I'm yeah. not laying yeah. myself up yeah. for another problem. Yeah. But fat, I actually cut down on saturated fat as well, because saturated fat, which you
butter
find in yes, in meats and things. That, so mm. and actually protein, red meat, you need to cut down as well. Processed mm. meat definitely is
no. classed no as a, and
exactly.
salami.
They are known to be carcinogens, so you need yeah. to cut down on those.
Yeah, no bacon.
Cut them right out. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
I think women fact, find that easy. Men don't. That's
no,
yeah.
You know, and there are some people who are on the ketogenic diet who still have a lot of these things. But, you know, it depends. Again, it depends on the type of cancer you have.
Yeah.
And what it's feeding on. Mm. But you, as long as you are blocking enough of the correct pathways, then,
so what
you know,
else? So fats?
So fat, so yeah. and the protein, I was, so I didn't go completely vegan, mm. but I did cut down on dairy, mm. Went teetotal for 5 years. I have the occasional glass now, mm. Sometimes a bit more. and as you said, I went off the rails in, you know, in 2000, and it was actually 2004. I really went off the rails.
Good,
but anyway,
good.
So, yeah.
Please, but, you've got to do it sometimes in your life.
I know, but it was dangerous. Oh, yeah, my God, yeah. it was dangerous.
Yeah, because you weren't so, past your 5 years, were you? That's why it was dangerous.
Well, I was almost there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because 99. Yeah. But then I'd had this leukemia thing, which was different. And I kind of tried to parcel that up because it was not officially... I had it diagnosed later by a hematologist, but... and the fact that I had all these, I had abnormal glycolysis, I had this deleted P53 gene, which only happens when you have cancer, and this something called TM2PK, which is a marker for this abnormal cancer metabolism. I had all of this going on in my blood. I had myelodysplasia, which are these abnormal blood cells, and all of this going on. So, and this was all new. And so I kept it quiet from my oncologist because I knew she would want to give me more chemo. I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even tell Andrew that I had this problem.
Because you knew he'd
because I knew
be sensible.
I was yeah. also looking at surrogacy yeah. at the yeah. time, and I didn't want to stop the progression of that.
Oh, God.
So I was kind of keeping it hidden.
Yeah.
And because I you know, I just wanted my life to carry on, and I was... so anxious to get anything that would help. And thank God I found the drugs that, and the big one, yeah. actually one of the big ones I took was something called dipridamole. Dipridamole is unknown in the cancer world, pretty much. It was discovered in the 1980s to be seriously good for cancer. But then...
What is it?
It's an antiplatelet drug. It used to be the number one sort of... Instead of statins, they used to... Before statins were invented or, you know, they used to use dipyrimol. And this was picked up by a lot of sports people trying to improve their metabolic health as they were sort of, you know... guess who used it? Lance Armstrong.
Oh, wow. That's what he got done for.
He got done... Well, he was using dipyrimol to stop platelets sticking together because he was taking something called EPOs. These are erythropoietin drugs, which increase the number of red blood cells that you have. So whilst he was increasing his red blood cells, he was taking the dipyrimol to stop them sticking together in order to cheat to get back in the saddle after his... Because he had stage 4 cancer. God. And nobody can work out why he survived. Mm. I know why he survived. I've had his trainer, who's a friend of my son, Sam. Mm. He's his... His son is a friend of Sam's, and he's been in my kitchen, and he looked at my dipyrimol, and oh, yes, I know what that is. And I said, yeah, because Lance Armstrong took it, and it was a big hitter for me. And, I mean, Lance Armstrong thinks he's this wonderful superhuman because he survived stage 4 cancer, actually. He was just very lucky that he had a doctor that knew about the metabolism, who knew about things that and steered him down this path.
Also which probably was a sports expert,
lucky.
You see.
He was extremely lucky. Mm. Extremely lucky. Mm. So he took something that actually helped his...
It's terrible that, in a way, he was done for it because he had to take it for his... illness, probably.
No, he didn't. He didn't have to take any of that for his illness.
Oh, right.
No, he took it purely and simply to cheat. He had no idea taking the dipyrimol.
But it actually did make him better.
Yeah. In fact, the EPOs stimulate more red blood cells, which actually oxygenate the blood. Now, they thought this would be a good idea for cancer, except it then increases the stickiness. They didn't think to add the dipyrimol at the same time.
Now tell me about actually starving the cancer, because fasting is a big thing you talk about. Which
intermittent fasting, I would say, is great.
Okay, personally, if I do it, I become so bad-tempered, grumpy. Yeah. I've got very low blood pressure.
Okay, well, you're probably feeding on glucose as your primary fuel to start with.
Yes.
The best way to go into an intermittent fast is probably to go on the ketogenic diet for about 3 to 5 days first.
Okay.
So that your body starts to switch into just metabolizing in a different way.
Okay.
And then your desire for sugar and carbs and everything else drops down, because the reason you get grouchy and everything is because you're going through this enormous swing of having glucose.
Yeah, because I tried to give up. I gave up this summer for about 3 or 4 months. I gave up all carbs, but I was so bad-tempered.
Yeah. Yeah, you see your glucose,
so
which is...
my husband said I've got to go back on them, so now I'm back on the brown bread and back on the brown rice.
So it's a matter of cutting down all of the glycemic...
the dates? The dark chocolate?
Tiny bit of chocolate, I will allow you.
Yeah.
But, you know, because it's got so many good things in. It's actually... dark chocolate can be, you know, it's got more polyphenols than green tea.
Doesn't
stop cancer in the same way, but it's kind of good for you.
So
don't have to be too obsessive.
Okay, let's just, because we have gone, we are at 67 minutes. I knew you'd be an hour one. I knew it when I met you.
Okay.
But just to say that I just want to know what people can take preventatively. Obviously, people have got it. If they really want, you know, these amazing details, they go out and buy your book, How to Starve Cancer by Jane McClelland. But just, and also they must join your Facebook group, which you give personal support to people. You've got over 6,000 members. And I was looking at today, and you'd already done 3 posts today. I was really impressed. But I just want to know, what should we, the average person who hasn't got cancer yet, hopefully, what could we take apart from green tea? Is there anything else we could do?
Yeah, look after your gut. So making sure that in these kefir drinks, if you haven't got cancer, dairy isn't such an awful thing. There are people who are very anti, you know, I think raw milk, actually, if you've got a reasonable, and make sure that you have got good gut flora and fauna to start with, because you don't want to be loading a whole mix onto a very poor diet gut to start with. So there are lots of really good probiotic things out there now. There's one called Simproof, which I think is very good for sort of laying the foundations, and then you need to take sort of the bifidobacteria on top. But certainly if you want to maintain that, you need to take you need to be making sure you don't have really sugary foods afterwards, because then, you know, because the sugary foods will feed the bad bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
But infections, non-steroidals, you know, if you use antibiotics, they can all create a problem long term with leaky gut. And leaky gut,
I've taken a lot of antibiotics because I had giardia, which I picked up in Peru.
Ooh, nasty.
Yeah. And then I had mastitis when I had children. I've had a lot of... Okay. And then last year I was ill for 5 months with a cold that wouldn't go, so I had to look on antibiotics.
Well, this is where berberine will help as well. It's a supplement that's not...
What's
particularly
berberine,
well, it's it can well, you can actually find it's a an alkaloid, but you can find that it's in quite a few plants like golden seal and things like that. So it's actually a very good tonic for the it'll change the gut flora and fauna and make it really good. So it's a natural antibiotic. Mm. And in fact, my husband swears by it now. If he gets any kind of cold, he's immediately takes, you know, takes
What's it.
It
called? Golden seal.
Golden seal is really good. But berberine is one of the actives and really good for reducing the blood glucose. Mm. And the way that both metformin and berberine work is by actually altering the way that you process sugars and in the gut.
What do you think of carcinogens? Because I was really ill and I took very strong oregano oil and it made me better. I believe it really did.
Yeah, oregano is very powerful.
Yeah.
There are an awful lot of immune stimulants out there which are very good. Mushrooms are particularly good. You know, there are a whole variant of different mushrooms. I use maitake defraction then, and I use cordyceps, and there's a whole host of different mushrooms which will stimulate the immune system. And in fact, I think, you know, if you go back to how we ate in the Paleolithic era, we were probably gathering an awful lot of mushrooms, and they contain something called chitin, which is part of the sort of cellulose makeup of it. But that actually feeds the good bacteria in the gut. Essentially, your immune system is based around your gut. So that is what you need to be focusing on. And we should probably be eating mushrooms most days if we can.
What about just ones from the shop, you know, like from my local Sainsbury's?
Portobello mushrooms, I think, are actually the ones with the most chitin.
Great.
Although they may not have the same... There are different elements to the, you know, the beta-glucans, etc. Mm. It all depends on the mix, but certainly mushrooms. Just go for mushrooms.
Okay. go big on mushrooms.
Yes, maitake, the shiitake, you know, go for those. They're really good at stimulating the immune system. They've got more beta-glucan and things, and that's really good. And the other thing to mention with the diet is just to make sure that you cut down on too much of the high glycemic foods, really.
Can I eat the brown rice? Can I eat the brown bread?
Yes. Yeah, you can. If you don't have cancer, I don't think that brown bread is such an evil thing. But, you know, and I think an occasional bit of berberine just to try an occasional intermittent fast. I mean, the Mosley 5-2 diet is actually quite good.
Yes, well, my husband does it. He does it twice a week.
Okay.
But I just find that, you know, by 11 o'clock, I'm just weeping.
Well,
you know?
A lot of women, I think our metabolisms are very different to men. Men find it far easier to do that.
Just think, they were going out hunting. Well, you know, so they had to go 2 or 3 days without food.
You're more fertile if you're bigger and if you have nutrients. Okay. So I think we were predisposed to
being... Yeah, my husband's 15 stone.
Yeah. We were predisposed to carrying more fat to actually being
But we were sitting weaving or making arrows or whatever. Yeah. So we probably had regular food and much more regular. And we weren't as... Whereas men can go off and starve for 3 or 4 days, you know.
Yeah, I think we... Yeah. As women, you know, my husband can just do an intermittent fast just like that. Mm. And he's actually been very good in when I was going through it. He tried to follow a similar kind of diet. Oh. So, you know, he did come out in sympathy with me.
Yeah, but the annoying thing is he was better than you at it, you know.
He's now the food police, you know. You'll see, if you watch it, he catches me out, isn't it? And my kids are now as bad as well. So, Mummy, you can't eat that.
Oh,
so
no, okay, lucky they're at school.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah.
Have you sneaky chocolates?
Exactly. A bit of dark chocolate's fine, it's fine.
Exactly.
You know?
So, yeah. Oh, well, that's so... so nice to meet you, and you are just a wealth of information. So people, as I said, people can go to you. How do they pay for advice from you? How are you making it into a business?
Oh, well, you know what? I give an awful lot away for free. And my Facebook group is Free Info. You go on there. It's cool. It's a really long name that most people can't find, and most people can't even spell my name. It's Jane McClelland. So that's McClelland. Jane McClelland. Lot of L's. Three L's. And only one C. So McClelland. Jane McClelland. Off-label drugs for cancer. That is my full group, and that's not just about the sort of cancer starving drugs. That's a whole array of different drugs that will actually help stop different elements of the cancer. So starving it is kind of key, but then you've got the growth factors, you've got all sorts of other things, so trigger apoptosis, which is cell death,
and now people are leaving Facebook, Jane. You've got to face it.
Yeah, I know.
Facebook.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram as well.
I've noticed people, you know, every week two or three people are leaving me, and I think it's, I don't think it's anything to Radio Gorge. I think they're leaving Facebook. So you said you're also on, they can contact you through Twitter and Facebook as well. I mean, Instagram.
I'm Jane Dory McClelland on Instagram. So that's Dorey. I should probably change it to How to Starve Cancer or something, just so people can find it. The good thing about Facebook is that people can really have these in-depth discussions, which you don't get on any other forum. And this is what I like about it. And I can check who's coming into my group as well. So they have to answer some questions. They have to tell me, you know, a couple of things, just, and then I check them out a bit. But having to do, I'm getting so many a day now. It's kind of getting out of hand.
It's global, isn't it?
I've kind of made a bit of a millstone for myself, really, because I now have so many messages, so many emails, so many, you know, and I am a bit swamped with it. My website is howtostarvecancer.com. So that's fairly easy to find. And that will steer you to to all the various different, social media bits. But certainly the group that...
The
book is key. The book is key, because it doesn't matter what you read in Facebook or on Twitter or whatever, that I pull it all together into this format that kind of makes you realise just... It's not as complex or as hard or as tricky as the oncologists. The oncologists are confused by it. They don't understand the cancer metabolism. Still not recognised. They still don't recognise diet as being critically important. They haven't cottoned onto that at all. Some of them have.
But luckily,
very, very few.
Jane McClelland has.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorge today. You are an inspiration for me, for everybody listening. I think you're an incredible woman.
Thank you.
And that's what you'll always find on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. Thank you. Feeling gorgeous.
So for more amazing women, just try Radio Gorgeous, darling. It's always there for you.